penalties for any kind of sexual unions between blacks and whites. And once they built that wall, they focused on uplifting the white race. That's why they were focused on white women like Carrie Buck. But then over the years, many blacks were sterilized. And in places like North Carolina in the 70s, it was a lot of poor black people who were sterilized.
So just before we end, explain when and why the U.S. scientific community gave up on eugenics.
Yeah, so at the beginning, they were among the biggest cheerleaders. The medical journals of the 1910s and 20s were enthusiastic about eugenics. Harvard geneticists were in favor of eugenics. Over time, though, it became discredited, I think in part because of the rise of the Nazis. So this Eugenics Record Office, which was a scientific pro-eugenics operation, was funded by the Carnegie Institution. They lost their funding in the late 30s because of the rise of Nazism.
Well, Adam Cohen, it's an astounding book. The book is called Imbeciles, The Supreme Court, American Eugenics, and the Sterilization of Carrie Buck. Adam Cohen is journalist and lawyer, previously member of the New York Times editorial board, former senior writer for Time magazine. He's the co-editor of the NationalBookReview.com. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Happy birthday to Ariel Boone. Democracy Now! Has three job openings. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Carla Wills. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is 5 o'clock. Next up is the evening news.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Tim DeChristopher Lecture, Wielding the Power of Vulnerability, Thursday, April 7th at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. Tim DeChristopher, as bitter 70, disrupted a Bureau of Land Management oil and gas auction in 2008 by outbidding oil companies for land parcels around Arches and Canyonlands National Parks in Utah. His actions led to a 21-month imprisonment. Again, that's a lecture by Tim DeChristopher titled Wielding the Power of Vulnerability, Thursday, April 7th at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church, 1211 Southwest Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Tune in this Friday at 11 a.m. as we remember the late, great Julie Bernard, who hosted KBOO's Art Focus program for 23 years.
The people that I'm talking to, I'm approaching them the same way that I feel an ordinary listener would. I'm hoping that I'm asking the questions that an ordinary person might ask going into the gallery and looking at the work. I try to ask what that person might ask.
Remembering Julie Bernard this Friday at 11 a.m.
Original father of cubism.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, in the wake of two murders of activists who were protesting the Agua Zarca Dam in Honduras, two European investment banks have suspended their support for the project.
As a part of Sunshine Week, looking at government spending, investigative reporter Robin Ryan lifts the veil surrounding the Defense Department.
And we'll take an in-depth look at superdelegates and how the Democratic Party chooses candidates.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, March 17th, St. Patrick's Day, 2016. I'm Robert Barncourt.
And I'm Lisa Loving. The Oregon State Justice Department is pursuing a criminal investigation on the constitutional sheriff who sided with the armed militants who took over the Malheur Wildlife Refuge. Grant County Sheriff Glenn Palmer met with the conservative protesters who threatened an armed takeover of the federal government and publicly took their side. State officials aren't commenting on exactly what Palmer is suspected of doing, but the investigation is being carried out by the Criminal Justice Division of the state DOJ. The constitutional sheriff movement promotes a fundamentalist reading of the Constitution, including opposition to gun control, immigration, and reproductive rights. Palmer is the third Oregon sheriff now under state criminal investigation. He joins Klamath County Sheriff Frank Skra, recently indicted on assault and official misconduct charges, and Multnomah County Sheriff Dan Staten, who was accused of alleged misconduct involving office employees.
And here in Oregon, just this morning, a delicate game of compromises has at last come to an end as a four-bill legislation package aimed at addressing the housing crisis was signed into effect by our governor, Kate Brown. The four bills will try to relieve the pressure put on Oregon residents suffering the most from acutely housing emergency. The most contentious of the bills was SB 1533, which legalized inclusionary zoning in Oregon. Inclusionary zoning in this case allows local governments to require that affordable housing projects be incorporated into 20% of new multi-unit construction projects. Critics of this bill point out that the affordable housing legislation does not target those in most dire need of relief. The legislation defines the median income of those in need of affordable housing at about $58,000 a year for a family of four. Industry groups peeled back another bill that in an earlier iteration provided protections for tenants and mandated that landlords help cover moving costs. In its current form, it still protects tenants from sudden evictions. It requires 90-day notice in no-cause evictions and makes illegal rent increases in the first year of month-to-month leases.
Activists opposing animal research at the Oregon Health and Science University Primate Research Lab say two primates have died there in the past year. Stop Animal Exploitation Now says they've received documents this week indicating one primate escaped and subsequently died and another strangled to death. The group also said this week that a source within the federal government has recently confirmed that OHSU is the target of an open case investigation by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Sane activists say they've filed an official complaint with the U.S. Department of Agriculture. They're pushing for the maximum fine of $10,000 per incident. Now, Sane says, January 14th, USDA inspection cited OHSU for the strangulation death of a monkey, which occurred because an outdated device was not removed. Hey, it's going to be Transgender Day of Visibility. Dialogue, Dissecting Systems of Oppression. It's a wonderful event happening tomorrow night at Tabor Space. And we're joined by Dwyn Baird and Yosha Ness. Welcome to the KBOO News.
Hi.
talk about this event. It looks amazing. What is it about?
Well, being trans myself and having Transgender Day of Visibility coming up on March 31st, we've just started an organization called RAGS, and we thought, hey, this is a great opportunity for our first event. So basically, this event is just going to be, we're going to have various speakers talking about the obstacles that transgender people face in their day-to-day lives in society, and we're going to, as the rather long title of the event says, we're going to dissect the systems of oppression, and it's going to be an open dialogue. So
how does it work? When people go, what will it look like?
There's going to be different speakers that are going to come in and talk about different obstacles that they've faced as transgender individuals, or as they've seen transgender individuals go through, or different ways that they've like helped with different obstacles.
And we'll have speakers who are experts and professionals speak about whatever they're an expert in, and then we'll have time for questions and time for all attendees to share their experiences, to connect with one another. And this is really going to be about breaking down the barriers that get in the way of acceptance and equality.
Dwyn and Yosha, why did you decide to make this event? What are some of the issues that you're facing?
Well, as I said, I am trans, so obviously this is something that's on my mind every day. One of the main issues, especially in Portland, that I've seen is a lot of like binary idealism. People think you are either male or female. Not a lot of attention is given to the non-binary folks and the folks in between or outside of that gender binary system. And also there's a lot of awareness elitism, sort of. Like, people think, I know that person. That person is trans. Because I know this trans person, I understand all of their issues. I know all of the experiences a trans person can have, and therefore I'm the best ally there can be. But oftentimes that is someone who just knows a little bit. They read off the internet or heard one of their trans acquaintances complaining about something, and then they think, hey, I got this. But they're spreading misinformation, and we are trying to open up the conversation to, like, get rid of misinformation and open up an opportunity for more people to get involved and to become allies and join the fight. Woo!
Duane, can you, for people that are listening now that mm-hmm. don't know these terms that you're talking about, binary people,
yeah.
can you define some of the terms that you think that people should be educating ourselves about and learning about? What does binary mean for people that have never heard that term?
Binary, in a scientific sense, technically is like when there's two of something. So binary in computer coding would be zero and one. And binary in terms of gender and sex is the idea that there's just male and female, and there's no in-between, there's nothing outside of that. You have to be either male or female, and you have to fit into one of those boxes. And a lot of people who are trans, transgender, also identify as non-binary or genderqueer is a word that is becoming used more and more, and that is someone who identifies as a little bit of male and a little bit of female, or like masculinity and femininity together, or neither masculine nor feminine, or something like that. And also a term that's tossed around quite a lot is cisgender, and that means someone whose biological sex and their gender identity line up and they match up, so they're not trans.
All right. If you just tuned in, we're talking with Duane Baird and Yosha Ness about this event tomorrow that's going to be at Tabor Space on Belmont, Transgender Day of Visibility Dialogue, Dissecting Systems of Oppression. When you walk down the street in Portland, Oregon, do you see ways that people are affected by this? Like the people in your community, the people that you're talking to, how are they affected by it?
Well, you know, a lot of people that are transgender deal with a lot of anxiety just from, like, the different ways that they've been oppressed and, like, treated by other people. And I definitely, like, have a lot of friends that are don't fit in with the gender binary. And so then they just, like, have lots of anxiety or, like, depression and, like, different stuff like that.
Especially around things like, like, gendered public bathrooms is always a big issue. You are hearing more and more about that in the news. But also things like going to a coffee shop and they ask for your name. That personally has been a major moment of stress for me, especially when I first came out. 'Cause you're always, Portland presents itself as such a welcoming, open community. But you're always afraid that someone's not okay with you being trans. You're always afraid that there's going to be someone who might use slurs, someone who might call you out on being different. And even in Portland, I have been yelled at, verbally assaulted, never physically assaulted. But I have actually, like, been afraid of that as a trans person, and I have quite a few trans friends who I see, they go through, like, I suppose the best way to say it is you're never completely out. You always have to choose with every person you meet whether to tell them or not, and we all go through a lot of anxiety every time we have to choose, so that is definitely a way that people are affected on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm. Did you want to add anything?
No, that's pretty much it.
All right. Can you talk about who some of the speakers are, some of the people that you're expecting at the event? Can you brag a little bit about the event itself?
So I have one friend who's going to come talk, and their name is Quali. And they're a person of color who is trans male to female. And they're also musicians, so they're going to come talk about kind of the struggles that they faced with, like, trying to get, like, jobs performing and, like, different issues that they've faced and obstacles and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. And we have a couple other speakers. Unfortunately, yesterday, one of our speakers dropped out, so... but the other people who are coming to speak are, like, healthcare professionals or people who work in those sorts of, like, public well-being fields.
Like social services, people who help people.
Yeah. So we're going to have them talk specifically about, like, the kind of obstacles trans people face in applying for public services and stuff. And also our principal, Pam Joyner, she's a hella queer, awesome lady.
Where do you go to school?
We go to the Metropolitan Learning Center, which is a K-12 school, which is super awesome because we get to influence a lot of young kids and be like, hey, it's okay to be different. And it's awesome.
So, one last question. Who do you think should be coming to this event?
Definitely. Well, this event will be a safe space for all members of the LGBTQ plus community and allies. We definitely want allies to come, and we definitely especially are targeting this event towards people who are family members, friends, loved ones, coworkers, peers of trans or even just generally LGBTQ plus people, anyone who might need the information.
All right. The Transgender Day of Visibility Dialogue will be held at Tabor Space in the Copeland Commons tomorrow, starting at 6 p.m.,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
And that's at 5441 Southeast Belmont. It's free. Anything mm-hmm. else anybody needs to know about it?
Children are welcome. This is a family-friendly event, but be aware that the speakers may use curse words and may talk about sexual organs. So,
all right. Dwyn Baird and Yosha Ness, really want to thank you for being here. They are with Raising Awareness for Gender and Sexuality, ragsportland.tumblr.com. Thanks for being with us.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with political columnist David Swanson about superdelegates and how the Democratic Party chooses its nominees. This will be followed by Rose City Native Radio at 6 o'clock, and at 7 tonight, it's Ear to the Streets of Portland, featuring the organizers of Sista Sista, a mentoring program for girls of African descent and some of the mentees themselves. Tomorrow's weather will be sunny all day with a few scattered clouds. There'll be a high of about 64 degrees, a low of 45, and no rain in sight. Today in history, in the year 624 AD, by our calendar, Muslim forces under the leadership of the Prophet Muhammad defeated a Meccan force at the Battle of Badr, cementing his status as a rising power in Arabia. And in 1959, the 14th and current Dalai Lama, Tenzin Gyatso, fled persecution in Tibet to India, where he still resides. The quote for today is from Univision journalist Jorge Ramos, known as the Walter Cronkite of Latin America, explaining his concept of journalism. Quote, "Sometimes you have to ask the question as if it's going to be your last question, as if it's going to be the last time you talk to that person."
Today's Sunshine Week transparency tool, Share Concerns, spending at the federal level for all agencies. It focuses on discrepancies between reporting venues as it applies to spending by the U.S. Department of Defense. Here's KABU reporter Robin Ryan with more on the pair of websites that track companies awarded contracts in addition to peripheral venues that look at original announcements and after-the-fact penalties.
Despite the presence of many an internet venue in existence to shed some light on military spending in the United States, the Department of Defense hasn't been able to pass an audit in more than 20 years. Information for today's Sunshine Week report is gleaned from a total of four websites relevant to the dynamics which cost taxpayers hundreds of billions each and every year. The United States Department of the Treasury maintains USAspending.gov, and though the data is reported as less than reliable by its critics, there's a privately run counterpart maintained by the Center for Effective Government called FedSpending.org. The difference in records for the Boeing Company between these two sites provide a good example of the level of miscalculation in play. USAspending.gov reports a total of $200 billion that's been paid via 126,000 transactions with Boeing. But according to the year-by-year record found at FedSpending.org, which only has records through the third quarter of 2012, totals $50 billion more than that. While this transparency tool share focuses on military spending, both sites track spending from all governmental agencies at the federal level, but variables in how the data is presented do make the two distinguishable from one another. For example, USA Spending's homepage can make it easy to access state-specific data, but the data sets at Fed Spending include and rank the level of funds by congressional district. Complements to this pair of resources include the Project on Government Oversight's Federal Contractor Misconduct Database, which we mentioned yesterday to report on how much Boeing's been fined for failing to meet terms and conditions laid out in the contracts they've been awarded. A notable but unrelated recent entry in POGO's database from just last month concerning Pfizer's subsidiary Wyeth Pharmaceuticals settled a suit brought by 18 states because the company failed to give the government discounts comparable to private purchasers of Protonix, which is a heartburn medication. POGO lists Boeing as the second highest penalized firm providing services to the United States government, but it seems without consequences they were awarded an $896 million contract from the Army just 48 hours ago, according to the Department of Defense's contracts page, Tissue Daily. That's Thursday's Sunshine Week Report. I'm Robin Ryan, and you're listening to KABU News.
It's 5:22. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Imagine the outcry by Tea Party Republicans if state legislators were passing laws banning the use of video cameras and banks to capture images of robbers. Yet, those very same Tea Partiers have been passing laws in various states to ban the use of videos to capture images of such giant factory farm operators as Tyson that are engaged in inhumane, immoral, and disgusting abuses of turkeys, hogs, and other animals. The only reason the public knows about chickens being stomped to death and pregnant sows being driven insane because they're caged so tightly that they can't even turn around is because courageous whistleblowers have secretly taped videos of the intolerable violence inside these animal concentration camps. In response to the videoed exposés, however, eight states run by shameless, corporate-hugging Republicans have rushed to protect the worst abusers, making it illegal to release such tapes to the media or the public. North Carolina's corrupt legislature, for example, has decreed that videoers who cause bad publicity for corporate animal torturers can be sued by the corporation and fined $5,000 for each day abuses are recorded. To add to the Kafkaesque absurdity of this ag-gag law, the state legislature's corporate butt-kissers mandated that releasing videos of abuses in nursing home chains, daycare centers, and veterans facilities is now also banned. This is Jim Hightower saying, in their eagerness to please corporate lobbyists and get campaign donations from these grossly abusive profiteers, Tea Party Republicans across the country are stomping on our constitutional rights to free speech and freedom of the press just as mindlessly as the animal abusers stomp chickens to death. For information and action tips on stopping this disgrace, go to aspca.org/openthebarns. Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out at hightowerlowdown.org.
Britain's conservative-led government is pushing ahead with its Investigatory Powers Bill. This is legislation that critics are calling the Snooper's Charter. The bill, which cleared a major parliamentary hurdle on Tuesday, would give law enforcement agencies sweeping powers to collect the public's internet and communications data without having to show probable cause or suspicion of wrongdoing. The Investigatory Powers Bill will ensure that online history is kept for a year, and it will allow authorities to hack into cell phones and other devices. Critics say that Prime Minister David Cameron's government has ignored demands by three separate parliamentary committees for the law to include better privacy protection for the public, and what's been dubbed as the most draconian spying law of any democratic country is likely to have ramifications right here in America, too. Nick Martin has more from London.
When NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden first leaked details of massive government surveillance programs back in 2013, the revelations led to calls for new legislation to ensure privacy protections and greater transparency over what happens to digital data. Fast forward to 2016, and the British government is now attempting to pass the controversial Investigatory Powers Bill, which explicitly legalizes mass warrantless surveillance of online activities. Some lawmakers have called for increased privacy protections, but campaigners have ridiculed a revised draft released earlier this month, calling it minor Botox. Matthew Rice is from the digital rights organisation Privacy International.
What they actually did was they went to part one of the bill that said general protections, and they added the word privacy to the title, general privacy protections. They haven't consolidated those protections. They haven't made it clear about how they're protecting our right to privacy. It's a clever game, but it's also almost mocking of the parliamentary process of review to have done that and to call this an increased privacy protective piece of legislation. It's almost worse than not listening.
Privacy advocates maintain the wording of the so-called Snooper's Charter is so vague it could authorise surveillance of anyone for any reason. British authorities have been keen to point out that the ability to spy digitally on suspects has helped in every counter-terrorism investigation in the last decade. When she first presented the IP bill to Parliament last November, Home Secretary Theresa May said the threats faced by the UK remained considerable and evolving.
They include not just terrorism from overseas and homegrown in the UK, but also industrial, military and state espionage. They include not just organised criminality, but also the proliferation of once physical crimes online, such as child sexual exploitation, and the technological challenges that brings. In the face of such threats, we have a duty to ensure that the agencies whose job it is to keep us safe have the powers they need to do the job.
But tech experts warn that gathering and storing ever larger amounts of sensitive data could actually increase vulnerabilities by expanding a target's attack surface. Haider Al-Khatib is an e-security and digital forensics lecturer at the University of Bedfordshire.
This data is not necessarily going to be used by authorized people, law enforcement. In fact, because cyber attacks are happening quite frequently nowadays, and we are all familiar with many examples, I mean, Sony, Apple, even these large enterprises. So the question is, can smaller companies maintain the privacy of this data and make sure that access will only be given to law enforcement?
The revised version of the IP bill also allows police departments to hack into computers and devices, something normally reserved for intelligence agencies. In the physical world, this is akin to police searching a home without the knowledge or consent of its residents. The newest draft of the bill would require judicial improvement and even a so-called double lock of judicial and ministerial consent to carry out what's known as equipment interference, thereby making it comparable to a no-knock warrant. The government says most of the 122 recommendations made by MPs have been included in the bill's revised text. The Investigatory Powers Bill is also likely to increase the scope of data shared between the UK and other members of the so-called Five Eyes Alliance, which includes intelligence agencies from the US, Canada, Australia and New Zealand. Again, Privacy International's Matthew Rice.
One of the big shaming points around the Snowden revelations was showing just how open these two countries, or the five countries ultimately, but just how open the sharing was. In fact, it once was described that the product generated from these investigations and this interception was almost indistinguishable from one country to the other. It's almost like they're all just filing into a bigger pot that they all belong to. And so when people are reading the Investigatory Powers Bill in the US, for instance, they should very much be looking for, what does it say about me as a foreigner? What does it say about me as someone who uses communications outside of the UK? Because that will have a very, very real effect.
Digital forensic specialist Haider Al-Khatib insists that the big law breakers, terrorist organisations and criminal gangs will probably take extra measures to remain one step ahead technologically.
It seems that the negative impact can be kind of focused then on the normal user rather than the person who already know is doing something wrong.
Sure.
And that's quite worrying.
The government's junior coalition partners rejected legislation very similar to the so-called Snoopers Charter in 2013. But with the centre-right Conservative Party governing alone in this term, many predict the revised law will clear Parliament by the end of the year. Nick Martin, FSRN, London.
Less than 2 weeks after Honduras's most internationally recognized activist, Berta Cáceres, was murdered, another key member of the organization she co-founded is dead, killed by gunmen. Shannon Young has more.
The Civic Council of Popular and Indigenous Organizations, also known as COPIN, is rallying its members in the Honduran capital to push back against what it calls a new wave of repression targeting land rights defenders in the country. On Tuesday, COPIN organizer Nelson Garcia was shot dead by two gunmen as he arrived at his mother-in-law's house for lunch. He had spent the morning helping 150 families move their belongings after soldiers and national police destroyed their homes and crops during a forced eviction from land claimed by both indigenous Lenca and an influential local politician. The National Police, the same agency handling the murder investigation of COPIN co-founder Berta Cáceres, issued a statement denying Garcia's death was in any way related to the land eviction it had helped carry out earlier that day. In an interview with the Radio Mundo Real Media Project, COPIN leader Tomás Gómez says the state of Honduras is operating like a de facto institutional dictatorship and hiding behind a veil of probable deniability.
Because we see in places where there are wars, declared wars, fewer people die. Meanwhile, in our country, where there's not a war going on, there's what seems like a spike in homicides and criminality. And this allows the government to make it look like the state or the authorities bear no responsibility. But the demands we're making as COPIN, as Lenca people, are fundamentally related to the context of the murder of Berta Cáceres.
The Cáceres family has called for an international investigation into the activist's murder, citing doubts about the ability of Honduran authorities to carry out an unbiased investigation, given her well-known opposition to numerous government policies. COPIN's activism intensified in the wake of the 2009 coup, which led to a number of privatization policies favoring international investment and a handful of powerful families. Gómez of COPIN says that far from dealing a single heavy blow, Cáceres' murder seems like an opening salvo to a campaign aimed at wiping out the organization.
We believe it's an avalanche that's been set up to try to get rid of us, to make sure that we, as Lenca people, lose our lands within Honduran territory. The state is primarily interested in taking away all the land from us that has minerals, water, oxygen, or natural resources, so that it can sell off concessions. Because we already know that 35% of the nation's territory is under license to transnational companies.
As the Cáceres murder investigation continues, the sole witness to the crime remains under a 30-day migratory alert, preventing him from leaving Honduras. Mexican and international organizations have expressed serious concerns about Gustavo Castro and call for his freedom to leave the country. The Mexican environmental campaigner says he has fully cooperated with Honduran authorities and will continue to do so upon his return to Mexico, which has a legal cooperation agreement with the Central American nation. The latest murder, however, seems to have caused at least one major investor to back out of Honduras. Citing ongoing violence and naming the two murdered Copin members, the Dutch development bank known as the FMO, one of the investors in the Aguas Arcadam project Cáceres so famously opposed, announced Wednesday that it has decided to, quote, suspend all activities in Honduras, effective immediately. For FSRN, I'm Shannon Young.
In the wake of the murders of Cáceres and Garcia, two large European development banks, as you just heard, the Dutch FMO and the Finnish Finnfund, have announced yesterday that they're suspending all involvement in the Aguas Arca project. This comes despite FMO's involvement in other controversial Latin American dam projects that have led to the murder of protesters, often indigenous people who are fighting displacement. For more on this, KBOO's Sam Bowman spoke with Peter Bossard, the interim executive director of the group International Rivers.
So these two financial institutions, FMO in the Netherlands and Finnfund from Finland, can you explain the relationship of these institutions to their respective governments?
FMO and Finnfund are financial institutions which are majority owned by the Dutch and the Finnish government, but they operate at arm's length. They operate without much public oversight, pretty much like a private bank.
How have FMO and Finnfund defended their involvement in projects like these where human rights abuses have been documented? Do they claim ignorance, or how do they dress that up?
You know, they will like to talk about the project as such, Aguas Arca and also other projects, dam projects in Central America, which had human rights abuses. They are not very big, so they say, look, these are relatively small dams. You can't compare them with the Three Gorges Dam in China or so. They bring electricity to countries which badly need it. But, of course, that doesn't change that. These are private projects which amount to land grabs and water grabs, which take away resources, particularly from indigenous peoples. And so there is very strong resistance. FMO and Finnfund have always said, well, we've always encouraged a peaceful resolution of these conflicts. We don't want to see violence. But if you invest in a country like Honduras, where violence against environmental defenders and land rights activists is so endemic, you know, that's almost a bit of a naive proposition that you can finance such a project, which is being resisted by the local people, and expect that there's not going to be violence.
What pressures were FMO and Finnfund responding to when they suspended their involvement in the project?
At the end of the day, we don't know exactly why they decided to suspend their funding. There has clearly been a very strong public reaction and outrage about the murder of Berta Cáceres. There were protests in front of the FMO headquarters. There was negative media coverage. There were protests around the world. We saw that even on Tuesday, the day before their suspension, they insisted that they would remain involved, that they couldn't break a contract which they had with the lender, with the dam builder. And so it's quite possible that after another land rights activist was killed in Honduras, it was the Dutch government which told its financier that, look, this is unacceptable. You have to suspend your operations. But this is just speculation. We don't know for sure.
What's next for the Aguas Arca dam if these institutions do withdraw? Is there another source of funding, or is that pretty much the end of the project?
There is another source of funding, the Central American Bank for Economic Integration, which is also a public financier, which is owned by the Central American governments, and it is really very non-accountable, and it has hardly responded at all to the murders in Honduras. But FMO and FinFund together account for almost half of the funding. So, Agua Zarca, the dam builder, would have problems replacing those loans, particularly after what has now happened. And so it's quite possible that the project would end. Probably not right away, but if they can't replace those loans, the project couldn't be completed.
All right. Peter Bosshart of the group International Rivers, thank you very much for talking with me today.
Thank you.
SeaWorld said today they are ending their captive orca breeding program and will be launching new partnerships to protect killer whales in the wild. The amusement park was targeted by a 2013 documentary film called Blackfish that showed the horrors of orcas in captivity forced to perform for human audiences. The film featured former SeaWorld whale trainers talking about what happens behind the scenes at SeaWorld. SeaWorld President Joel Manby said in a letter to the Los Angeles Times published today that changing social attitudes towards the industry triggered the change in policy. He said the current whales living in their facilities would be, quote, the last generation of orcas in SeaWorld's care. Last year, SeaWorld announced they were ending orca performances at their facilities in Florida, Texas, and California.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast. We do encourage your participation. You can call us with your breaking news stories here at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Jamie Haddad, Demi Hellenius, Robin Ryan, Kanan Schlesinger, Jenna Yokoyama, Natasha Delapine, and Theo Burke. The producer is Sam Bowman, and our engineer holding all this together is Matthew Olson. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director and sometimes co-anchor is Lisa Loving. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or you can look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Robert Barncourt.
Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's Positively Revolting Talk Radio. Hosts Ani and Lynn celebrate the equinox with astral tarot readings. At 9, Marvin and Angie of Northwest Vets for Peace host Veterans Voice with Northwest Veterans for Peace. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, we remember Art Focus host Julie Bernard. We honor the life and work of the former volunteer who hosted Art Focus for 23 years. She passed away just a few months ago. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. Not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Good night, Robert.
Good night, Lisa.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
In the Democratic and the Republican race for the presidential nomination, delegates must vote according to the choices their constituents make in the party primaries and caucuses. Superdelegates, on the other hand, get to vote for whichever nominee they choose to. Superdelegates are party senators, congresspeople, governors, Democratic or Republican national committee officials, and other influential figures working on careers within the institution of their own political party. For this reason, they have a tendency to vote according to what would advance their own careers instead of, say, in solidarity with constituents in their home states. Superdelegates also draw intense media coverage, as they can be used to misrepresent presidential nominee races. Author and activist David Swanson is in the process of advocating for greater accountability and integrity from Democratic superdelegates. His objective is to get them to vote in alignment with their constituents instead of any myriad of side interests. KABU reporter Theo Burke spoke with Swanson to gain insight into this contentious facet of American politics.
I'm here with David Swanson, the campaign coordinator for RootsAction.org. Thank you for joining us on KABU Radio tonight, David.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
First of all, before we talk about the superdelegates in the Democratic Party, David is going to be in town for two events on April 16th at the First Unitarian Church and also on the Portland State campus. And what will you be speaking about at those events, David?
Well, I'll be on a little book tour, and I'm talking about my new book, which is called War is a Lie, the second edition. So it's an updated book that originally came out 5 years ago. You can see all about it at warisalie.org.
Yeah, warisalie.org is where you can read more about what David's doing. And he'll be speaking on this on April 16th, first at the First Unitarian Church downtown at 1101 Southwest 12th Avenue from 10 to 1130, and then at Hoffman Hall on the Portland State University campus. So it'll be great to have you in town, David. But right now, we're anxious to talk to you tonight about the superdelegates. You have a pledge on rootsaction.org that has crossed 29,000 signatures out of a goal of 30,000?
Yeah, that's right. It's actually on our do-it-yourself site where people make their own petitions. So if you go to diy.rootsaction.org, you'll see that petition and many others, and you can make your own. And they have proven very successful tools, in fact, as part of campaigns that have won lots of changes. Whether this one works remains to be seen.
Right. This petition is asking the Democratic Party superdelegates to pledge to vote in with the winner of their state primary elections rather than holding their existing superdelegate privilege of voting for whichever candidate they want. Does that sound right?
Right, that they represent their constituents. So if their constituents are